During our last two Cambridge years, my brother and I used to spend vacations in Berlin, where our parents, with the two girls and 10-year-old Kirill, occupied one of those large, gloomy, eminently bourgeois apartments that I have let to so many émigré families in my novels and short stories. On the night of March 28, 1922, around 10 o'clock, in the living room, where as usual my mother was reclining on the red plush corner couch, I happened to be reading to her Bloch's verse on Italy. Had just got to the end of the little poem about Florence, which Bloch compares to the delicate, smoky bloom of an iris, and she was saying over her knitting,
"Yes, yes, Florence does look like a dimly iris. How true! I remember..."
when the telephone rang. After 1923, when she moved to Prague and I lived in Germany and France, I was unable to visit her frequently, nor was I with her at her death, which occurred on the eve of World War II. Whenever I did manage to go to Prague, there was always that initial pang one feels just before time, caught unawares, again dons its familiar mask. In the pitiable lodgings she shared with her dearest companion, Evgenia Konstantinovna Hofeld, 1884-1957, who had replaced in 1914 Miss Greenwood, who in her turn had replaced Miss Lavington as governess of my two sisters, Olga, born January 5, 1903, and Elena, born March 31, 1906, albums in which during the last years she had copied out her favorite poems from Maikov to Mayakovsky, lay around her on odds and ends of decrepit second-hand furniture. A cast of my father's hand and a watercolor picture of his grave in the Greek Catholic cemetery of Tegel, now in East Berlin, shared a shelf with émigré writers' books, so prone to disintegration in their cheap paper covers. A soapbox covered with green cloth supported the dim little photographs in crumbling frames she liked to have near her couch. She did not really need them, for nothing had been lost, as a company of traveling players carry with them everywhere while they still remember their lines, a windy heath, a misty castle, an enchanted island, so she had with her all that her soul had stored. With great clarity I can see her sitting at a table and serenely considering the laid-out cards of a game of solitaire. She leans on her left elbow and presses to her cheek the free thumb of her left hand, in which, close to her mouth, she holds a cigarette, while her right hand stretches toward the next card. The double gleam on her fourth finger is two marriage rings, her own and my father's, which, being too large for her, is fastened to hers by a bit of black thread. Whenever in my dreams I see the dead, they always appear silent, bothered, strangely depressed, quite unlike their dear, bright selves. I am aware of them, without any astonishment, in surroundings they never visited during their earthly existence, in the house of some friend of mine they never knew. They sit apart, frowning at the floor as if death were a dark taint, a shameful family secret. It is certainly not then, not in dreams, but when one is wide awake, at moments of robust joy and achievement, on the highest terrace of consciousness, that mortality has a chance to peer beyond its own limits, from the mast, from the past and its castle tower. And although nothing much can be seen through the mist, there is somehow the blissful feeling that one is looking in the right direction. Chapter 3. 1. An inexperienced heraldist resembles a medieval traveler who brings back from the East the faunal fantasies influenced by the domestic bestiary he possessed all along, rather than by the results of direct zoological exploration. Thus, in the first version of this chapter, when describing the Nabokov's coat of arms, carelessly glimpsed among some familial trivia many years before, I somehow managed to twist it into the fireside wonder of two bears posing with a great chessboard propped up between them. I have now looked it up, that blazon, and I'm disappointed to find that it boils down to a couple of lions, brownish and perhaps over-shaggy beasts, but not really ursine, licking their chops, rampant, regardant, arrogantly demonstrating the unfortunate knight's shield, which is only 1/16 of a checkerboard, of alternate tinctures, azure and gules, with a botonnet cross, argent, in each rectangle. Above it one sees what remains of the knight, his tough helmet and inedible gorget, as well as one brave arm coming out of a foliate ornament, gules and azure, and still brandishing a short sword. Zachrabrost, for valor, says the scripture. According to my father's first cousin, Vladimir Viktorovich Golubtsov, a lover of Russian antiquities, whom I consulted in 1930, the founder of our family was Nabok Murza, Floruit 1380, a Russianized Tatar prince in Muscovy. My own first cousin, Sergei Sergeyevich Nabokov, a learned genealogist, informs me that in the 15th century our ancestors owned land in the Moscow princedom. He refers me to a document published by Yushkov in Acts of the 13th to 17th Centuries, Moscow, 1899, concerning a rural squabble which in the year 1494, under Ivan III, Squire Kulyakin had with his neighbors Filat, Evdokim, and Vlas, sons of Luka Nabokov. During the following centuries, the Nabokovs were government officials and military men. My great-great-grandfather, General Alexander Ivanovich Nabokov, 1749-1807, was in the reign of Paul I, chief of the Novgorod Garrison Regiment, called Nabokov's Regiment in official documents. The youngest of his sons, my great-grandfather Nikolai Alexandrovich Nabokov, was a young naval officer in 1817, when he participated with the future admirals Baron von Wrangel and Count Littke, under the leadership of Captain, later Vice Admiral, Vasily Mikhailovich Golovnin, in an expedition to map Nova Zemlya, of all places, where Nabokov's River is named after my ancestor. The memory of the leader of the expedition is preserved in quite a number of place names, one of them being Golovnin's Lagoon, Seward Peninsula, West Alaska, from where a butterfly, Parnassius Phoebus Golovinus, rating a big sick, has been described by Dr. Holland. But my great-grandfather has nothing to show except that very blue, almost indigo blue, even indignantly blue, little river winding between wet rocks. For he soon left the navy, n'ayant pas le pied marin, as says my cousin Sergei Sergeyevich, who informed me about him, and switched to the Moscow Guards. He married Anna Alexandrovna Nazimov, sister of the Decembrist. I know nothing about his military career. Whatever it was, he could not have competed with his brother, Ivan Alexandrovich Nabokov, 1787-1852, one of the heroes of the anti-Napoleon wars, and in his old age commander of the Peter and Paul fortress in St. Petersburg, where in 1849 one of his prisoners was the writer Dostoevsky, author of The Double, etc., to whom the kind general lent books. Considerably more interesting, however, is the fact that he was married to Ekaterina Pushkin, sister of Ivan Pushkin, Pushkin's schoolmate and close friend. Careful printers, two chins and one kin. The nephew of Ivan and the son of Nikolai was my paternal grandfather Dmitri Nabokov, 1827-1904, minister of justice for 8 years under two tsars. He married, September 24, 1859, Maria, the 17-year-old daughter of Baron Ferdinand Nicolaus Victor von Korff, 1805-1869, a German general in the Russian service. In tenacious old families, certain facial characteristics keep recurring as indicants and maker's marks. The Nabokov nose, e.g. my grandfather's, is of the Russian type, with a soft, round, upturned tip and a gentle inslope in profile. The Korff nose, e.g. mine, is a handsome Germanic organ with a boldly boned bridge and a slightly tilted, distinctly grooved, fleshy end. The supercilious or surprised Nabokovs have rising eyebrows, only proximally haired, thus fading toward the temples. The Korff eyebrow is more finely arched, but likewise rather scanty. Otherwise, the Nabokovs, as they recede through the picture gallery of time into the shadows, soon joined the dim Rukavishnikovs, of whom I knew only my mother and her brother Vasily, too small a sample for my present purpose. On the other hand, I see very clearly the women of the Korf line, beautiful lily-and-rose girls, their high, flushed pommette, pale blue eyes, and that small beauty spot on one cheek, a patch-like mark, which my grandmother, my father, three or four of his siblings, some of my 25 cousins, my younger sister, and my son Dmitri inherited in various stages of intensity as more or less distinct copies of the same print. My German great-grandfather, Baron Ferdinand von Korf, who married Nina Alexandrovna Shishkov, 1819-1895, was born in Königsberg in 1805, and after a successful military career, died in 1869 in his wife's Wolgan domain near Saratov. He was the grandson of Wilhelm Karl, Baron von Korf, 1739-1799, and Eleonore Margareta, Baroness von der Ostensacken, 1731-1786, and the son of Nicolas von Korf, died 1812, a major of the Prussian army, and Antoinette Theodora Graun, died 1859, who was the granddaughter of Karl Heinrich Graun, the composer. Antoinette's mother, Elizabeth née Fischer, born 1760, was the daughter of Regina, born Hartung, 1732-1805, daughter of Johann Heinrich Hartung, 1699-1765, head of a well-known publishing house in Königsberg. Elizabeth was a celebrated beauty. After divorcing her first husband, Justizrat Graun, the composer's son, in 1795, she married the minor poet Christian August von Stagemann, and was the motherly friend, as my German source puts it, of a much better-known writer, Heinrich von Kleist, 1777-1811, who at 33 had fallen passionately in love with her 12-year-old daughter, Hedwig Marie, later von Olfers. He is said to have called on the family to say adieu before traveling to Wannsee for the carrying out of an enthusiastic suicide pact with a sick lady, but was not admitted, it being laundry day in the Stagemann household. The number and diversity of contacts that my ancestors had with the world of letters are truly remarkable. Karl Heinrich Graun, the great-grandfather of Ferdinand von Korf, my great-grandfather, was born in 1701 at Warenbruck, Saxony. His father, August Graun, born 1670, an exciseman, königlicher polnischer und kurfürstlicher sächsischer Aktieneinnehmer, the elector in question being his namesake, August II, King of Poland, came from a long line of parsons. His great-great-grandfather, Wolfgang Graun, was in 1575 organist at Plauen near Warenbruck, where a statue of his descendant, the composer, graces a public garden. Karl Heinrich Graun died at the age of 58 in 1759 in Berlin, where 17 years earlier the new opera house had opened with his Caesar and Cleopatra. He was one of the most eminent composers of his time, and even the greatest, according to local necrologists touched by his royal patron's grief. Graun is shown, posthumously, standing somewhat aloof, with folded arms, in Menzel's picture of Frederick the Great playing Graun's composition on the flute. Reproductions of this kept following me through all the German lodgings I stayed in during my years of exile. I am told there is at the Sanssouci Palace in Potsdam a contemporary painting representing Graun and his wife Dorothea Rehkop sitting at the same clavicin. Musical encyclopedias often reproduce the portrait in the Berlin Opera House, where he looks very much like the composer Nikolai Dmitrievich Nabokov, my first cousin. An amusing little echo, to the tune of $250, from all those concerts under the painted ceilings of a gilded past, blandly reached me in Heil Hitlering Berlin in 1936, when the Graun family entail, basically a collection of pretty snuffboxes and other precious knick-knacks, whose value after passing through many avatars in the Prussian State Bank had dwindled to 43,000 Reichmarks, about $10,000, was distributed among the provident composer's descendants, the von Korf, von Wissmann, and Nabokov clans. A fourth line, the Counts Asinari di San Marzano, had died out. Two baronesses, von Korff, have left their trace in the police records of Paris. One, born Anna Christina Stegelmann, daughter of a Swedish banker, was the widow of Baron Fromhold Christian von Korff, colonel in the Russian army, a great-granduncle of my grandmother. Anna Christina was also the cousin, or the sweetheart, or both, of another soldier, the famous Count Axel von Fersen, and it was she who, in Paris in 1791, lent her passport and her brand-new custom-made traveling coach, a sumptuous affair on high red wheels, upholstered in white Utrecht velvet, with dark green curtains and all kinds of gadgets, then modern, such as a vase de voyage, to the royal family for their escape to Varennes, the queen impersonating her, and the king the tutor of the two children. The other police story involves a less dramatic masquerade. With Carnival Week nearing, in Paris, more than a century ago, the Count de Morny invited to a fancy ball at his house une noble dame que la Russie a traité cet hiver à la France, as reported by Henri in the Gazette du Palais section of the Illustration, 1859, page 251. This was Nina, Baroness von Korff, whom I have already mentioned. The eldest of her five daughters, Maria, 1842 to 1926, was to marry in September of the same year, 1859, Dmitri Nikolaevich Nabokov, 1827 to 1904, a friend of the family who was also in Paris at the time. In view of the ball, the lady ordered for Maria and Olga flower girl costumes, at 220 francs each. Their cost, according to the glib Illustration reporter, represented 643 days de nourriture, de loyer et d'entretien du père Crépin, food, rent, and footwear, which sounds odd. When the costumes were ready, Madame de Korff found them trop décolleté and refused to take them. The dressmaker sent her huissier, warrant officer, upon which there was a bad row, and my good-great-grandmother, she was beautiful, passionate, and I am sorry to say, far less austere in her private morals than it would appear from her attitude toward low necklines, sued the dressmaker for damages. She contended that the demoiselles de magasin who brought the dresses were des péronnelles, saucy hussies, who, in answer to her objecting that the dresses were cut too low for gentlewomen to wear, se sont permis d'exposer des théories égalitaires du plus mauvais goût, dared to flaunt democratic ideas in the worst of taste. She said that it had been too late to have other fancy dresses made, and that her daughters had not gone to the ball. She accused the huissier and his acolytes of sprawling on soft chairs while inviting the ladies to take hard ones. She also complained, furiously and bitterly, that the huissier had actually threatened to jail Monsieur Dmitri Nabokov, conseiller d'état, homme sage et plein de mesures, a sedate, self-contained man, only because the said gentleman had attempted to throw the huissier out of the window. It was not much of a case, but the dressmaker lost it. She took back her dresses, refunded their cost, and in addition paid 1,000 francs to the plaintiff. On the other hand, the bill presented in 1791 to Christina by her carriage maker, a matter of 5,944 livres, had never been paid at all. Dmitri Nabokov, the ending in FF, was an old continental fad. State Minister of Justice from 1878 to 1885, did what he could to protect, if not to strengthen, the liberal reforms of the 60s, trial by jury, for instance, against ferocious reactionary attacks. He acted, says a biographer, Brockhaus's Encyclopedia, Second Russian Edition, much like the captain of a ship in a storm, who would throw overboard part of the cargo in order to save the rest. The epitaphical simile unwittingly echoes, I note, an epigraphical theme, my grandfather's earlier attempt to throw the law out of the window. At his retirement, Alexander III offered him to choose between the title of count and a sum of money, presumably large. I do not know what exactly an earldom was worth in Russia, but contrary to the thrifty Tsar's hopes, my grandfather, as also his uncle Ivan, who had been offered a similar choice by Nicholas I, plumped for the more solid reward. Encore un compte raté, dryly comments Sergei Sergeyevich. After that, he lived mostly abroad. In the first years of this century, his mind became clouded, but he clung to the belief that as long as he remained in the Mediterranean region, everything would be all right. Doctors took the opposite view, and thought he might live longer in the climate of some mountain resort or in northern Russia. There is an extraordinary story, which I have not been able to piece together adequately, of his escaping from his attendants somewhere in Italy. There he wandered about, denouncing with King Lear-like vehemence his children to grinning strangers, until he was captured in a wild, rocky place by some matter-of-fact carabinieri. During the winter of 1903, my mother, the only person whose presence in his moments of madness the old man could bear, was constantly at his side in Nice. My brother and I, aged 3 and 4 respectively, were also there with our English governess. I remember the window panes rattling in the bright breeze, and the amazing pain caused by a drop of hot sealing wax on my finger. Using a candle flame, diluted to a deceptive pallor by the sunshine that invaded the stone slabs on which I was kneeling, I had been engaged in transforming dripping sticks of the stuff into gluey, marvelously smelling, scarlet and blue and bronze-colored blobs. The next moment I was bellowing on the floor, and my mother had hurried to the rescue, and somewhere nearby my grandfather in a wheelchair was thumping the resounding flags with his cane. She had a hard time with him. He used improper language. He kept mistaking the attendant who rolled him along the Promenade des Anglais for Count Loris Melikoff, a long-deceased colleague of his in the ministerial cabinet of the 80s. "Qui est cette femme? Chassez-la!" he would cry to my mother as he pointed a shaky finger at the Queen of Belgium or Holland, who had stopped to inquire about his health. Dimly I recall running up to his chair to show him a pretty pebble, which he slowly examined, and then slowly put into his mouth. I wish I had had more curiosity when in later years my mother used to recollect those times. He would lapse for ever-increasing periods into an unconscious state. During one such lapse he was transferred to his pied-à-terre on the Palace Quay in St. Petersburg. As he gradually regained consciousness, my mother camouflaged his bedroom into the one he had had in Nice. Some similar pieces of furniture were found, and a number of articles rushed from Nice by a special messenger, and all the flowers his hazy senses had been accustomed to were obtained in their proper variety and profusion, and a bit of house wall that could be just glimpsed from the window was painted a brilliant white, so every time he reverted to a state of comparative lucidity, he found himself safe on the illusory Riviera, artistically staged by my mother. And there, on March 28, 1904, exactly 18 years, day for day, before my father, he peacefully died. He left 4 sons and 5 daughters. The eldest was Dmitri, who inherited the Nabokov Majorat in the then Tsardom of Poland. His first wife was Lydia Eduardovna Falsfine, his second, Marie Redlich. Next came Sergei, governor of Mitau, who married Daria Nikolaevna Tuchkov, the great-great-granddaughter of Field Marshal Kutuzov, Prince of Smolensk. Then came my father. The youngest was Konstantin, a confirmed bachelor. The sisters were Natalia, wife of Ivan de Peterson, Russian consul at The Hague, Vera, wife of Ivan Pihachev, sportsman and landowner, Nina, who divorced Baron Rausch von Traubenberg, military governor of Warsaw, to marry Admiral Nikolai Kolomeitsev, hero of the Japanese War, Elisaveta, married to Henri, Prince Sein Wittgenstein Berlburg, and, after his death, to Roman Leichmann, former tutor of her sons, and Nadezhda, wife of Dmitri von Lyal-Yarsky, whom she later divorced. Uncle Konstantin was in the diplomatic service, and in the last stage of his career in London conducted a bitter and unsuccessful struggle with Sablin as to which of them would head the Russian mission. His life was not particularly eventful, but he had had a couple of nice escapes from a fate less tame than the draft in a London hospital, which killed him in 1927. Once in Moscow on February 17, 1905, when an older friend, the Grand Duke Sergei, half a minute before the explosion, offered him a lift in his carriage, and my uncle said, "No thanks, he'd rather walk," and away rolled the carriage to its fatal rendezvous with a terrorist's bomb. and the second time, 7 years later, when he missed another appointment, this one with an iceberg, by chancing to return his Titanic ticket. We saw a good deal of him in London after we had escaped from Lenin's Russia. Our meeting at Victoria Station in 1919 is a vivid vignette in my mind. My father marching up to his prim brother with an unfolding bear hug, he backing away and repeating, "Mi Vangli, mi Vangli, we are in England." His charming little flat was full of souvenirs from India, such as photographs of young British officers. He is the author of The Ordeal of a Diplomat, 1921, easily obtainable in large public libraries, and of an English version of Pushkin's Boris Godunov. And he is portrayed, goatee and all, together with Count Witte, the two Japanese delegates and a benevolent Theodore Roosevelt, in a mural of the signing of the Portsmouth Treaty on the left side of the main entrance hall of the American Museum of Natural History. An eminently fit place to find my surname in gold Slavic letters, as I did the first time I passed there with a fellow lepidopterist who said, "Sure, sure," in reply to my exclamation of recognition. 2. Diagrammatically, the three family estates on the Oradish, 50 miles south of St. Petersburg, may be represented as three linked rings in a 10-mile chain running west-east across the Luga Highway, with my mother's Vera in the middle, her brother's Rozhestvenno on the right, and my grandmother's Batovo on the left. The links being the bridges across the Oradish, which, in its winding, branching, and looping course, bathed Vera on either side. Two other, much more distant estates in the region were related to Batovo. My uncle Prince Wittgenstein's Druznozelje, situated a few miles beyond the Sivierski railway station, which was 6 miles northeast of our place, and my uncle Pihachev's Mityoshino, some 50 miles south on the way to Luga. I never once was there, but we fairly often drove the 10 miles or so to the Wittgensteins, and once in August 1911 visited them at their other splendid estate, Kamienka, in the province of Podolsk, southwest Russia. The estate of Batovo enters history in 1805, when it becomes the property of Anastasia Matveyevna Rileyev, born Essen. Her son, Kondraty Fyodorovich Rileyev, 1795-1826, minor poet, journalist, and famous Decembrist, spent most of his summers in the region, addressed elegies to the Oradesh, and sang Prince Alexei's castle, the jewel of its banks. Legend and logic, a rare but strong partnership, seem to indicate, as I have more fully explained in my notes to Onyegin, that the Rileyev pistol duel with Pushkin, of which so little is known, took place in the Batovo Park between May 6th and 9th, old style, 1820. Pushkin and two friends, Baron Anton Delvig and Pavel Yakovlev, who were accompanying him a little way on the first lap of his long journey from St. Petersburg to Ekaterinoslav, had quietly turned off the Luga Highway at Rozhestvenno, crossed the bridge, hoof-thud changing to brief clatter, and followed the old rutty road westward to Batovo. There, in front of the manor house, Rileyev was eagerly awaiting them. He had just sent his wife in her last month of pregnancy to her estate near Voronezh, and was anxious to get the duel over, and, God willing, join her there. I can feel upon my skin and in my nostrils the delicious country roughness of the northern spring day which greeted Pushkin and his two seconds as they got out of their coach and penetrated into the Linden Avenue beyond the Batovo platbands, still virginally black. I see so plainly the three young men, the sum of their years equals my present age, following their host and two persons unknown into the park. At that date, small crumpled violets showed through the carpet of last year's dead leaves, and freshly emerged orange tips settled on the shivering dandelions. For one moment, fate may have wavered between preventing a heroic rebel from heading for the gallows and depriving Russia of Eugene Onyegin, but then did neither. A couple of decades after Rileyev's execution on the bastion of the Peter and Paul Fortress in 1826, Batovo was acquired from the state by my paternal grandmother's mother, Nina Alexandrovna Shishkov, later Baroness von Korff, from whom my grandfather purchased it around 1855. Two tutor and governess-raised generations of Nabokovs knew a certain trail through the woods beyond Batovo as Le Chemin du Pendu, the favorite walk of the hanged one, as Ryleyev was referred to in society, callously but also euphemistically and wonderingly, gentlemen in those days were not often hanged, in preference to the Decembrist or the insurgent. I can easily imagine young Ryleyev in the green skeins of our woods, walking and reading a book, a form of romantic ambulation in the manner of his era, as easily as I can visualize the fearless lieutenant defying despotism on the bleak Senate Square with his comrades and puzzled troops. But the name of the long, grown-up promenade, looked forward to by good children, remained throughout boyhood unconnected in our minds with the fate of the unfortunate master of Batovo. My cousin Sergei Nabokov, who was born at Batovo in La Chambre du Revenant, imagined a conventional ghost, and I vaguely surmised, with my tutor or governess, that some mysterious stranger had been found dangling from the aspen upon which a rare hawk moth bred. That Ryleyev may have been simply the hanged one, Povshenny, or Veselnik, to the local peasants, is not unnatural. But in the manorial families, a bizarre taboo prevented, apparently, parents from identifying the ghost, as if a specific reference might introduce a note of nastiness into the glamorous vagueness of the phrase designating a picturesque walk in a beloved country place. Still, I find it curious to realize that even my father, who had so much information about the Decembrists, and so much more sympathy for them than his relatives, never once, as far as I can recall, mentioned Kondraty Ryleyev during our rambles and bicycle rides in the environs. My cousin draws my attention to the fact that General Ryleyev, the poet's son, was a close friend of Tsar Alexander II, and of my grandfather, D. N. Nabokov, and that on ne parle pas de cordes dans la maison du pendu. From Batovo, the old rutty road, which we have followed with Pushkin and now retrace, ran east for a couple of miles to Rozhestvenno. Just before the main bridge, one could either turn north in open country toward our Vira and its two parks on each side of the road, or else continue east, down a steep hill past an old cemetery choked with raspberry and race mosa, and cross the bridge toward my uncle's white-pillared house aloof on its hill. The estate, Rozhestvenno, with a large village of the same name, extensive lands, and a manor house high above the Oradesh River, on the Luga or Warsaw Highway, in the district of Tsarkoe Selo, now Pushkin, about 50 miles south from St. Petersburg, now Leningrad, had been known before the 18th century as the Kurovitz domain, in the old Koporsk district. Around 1715 it had been the property of Prince Alexei, the unfortunate son of that arch-bully Peter I. Part of an escalier dérobé, and something else I cannot recollect, were preserved in the new anatomy of the building. I have touched the banister and have seen, or trod on, the other forgotten detail. From that palace, along that highway leading to Poland and Austria, the prince had escaped, only to be lured back from as far south as Naples to the paternal torture house by the Tsar's agent, Count Pyotr Andreyevich Tolstoy, a one-time ambassador in Constantinople, where he had obtained for his master the little blackamoor whose great-grandson was to be Pushkin. Rozhestvenno later belonged, I believe, to a favorite of Alexander I, and the manor had been partly rebuilt when my maternal grandfather acquired the domain around 1880. For his eldest son Vladimir, who died at 16 a few years later. His brother Vasily inherited it in 1901 and spent there 10 summers out of the 15 that still remained to him. I particularly remember the cool and sonorous quality of the place, the checkerboard flagstones of the hall, 10 porcelain cats on a shelf, a sarcophagus and an organ, the skylights and the upper galleries, the colored dusk of mysterious rooms, and carnations and crucifixes everywhere. 3. In his youth, Karl Heinrich Graun had a fine tenor voice. One night, having to sing in an opera written by Schurmann, chapelmaster of Brunswick, he got so disgusted with some airs in it that he replaced them by others of his own composition. Here I feel the shock of gleeful kinship. Yet I prefer two other ancestors of mine, the young explorer already mentioned, and that great pathologist, my mother's maternal grandfather, Nikolai Ilarionovich Kozlov, 1814-1889, first president of the Russian Imperial Academy of Medicine, and author of such papers as On the Development of the Idea of Disease, or On the Coarctation of the Jugular Foramen in the Insane. At this convenient point, I may as well mention my own scientific papers, and especially my three favorite ones. Notes on Neotropical Plebigeni, CK, Volume 52, Numbers 1 to 2 and 3 and 4, 1945. A New Species of Cyclargus Nabokov, The Entomologist, December 1948. And the Near Arctic Members of the Genus Lycaeides Hubner, Bulletin Mus. Comp. Zool. Harvard Cull, 1949, after which year I found it no longer physically possible to combine scientific research with lectures, belles lettres, and Lolita, for she was on her way. A painful birth, a difficult baby. The Rukavishnikov blazon is more modest, but also less conventional than the Nabokov one. The escutcheon is a stylized version of a domna, primitive blast furnace, in allusion, no doubt, to the smelting of the Uralian ores that my adventurous ancestors discovered. I wish to note that these Rukavishnikovs, Siberian pioneers, gold prospectors, and mining engineers, were not related, as some biographers have carelessly assumed, to the no less wealthy Moscow merchants of the same name. My Rukavishnikovs belonged, since the 18th century, to the landed gentry of Kazan province. Their mines were situated at Alopayevsk, near Nizhny Tagilsk, province of Perm, on the Siberian side of the Urals. My father had twice traveled there on the former Siberian Express, a beautiful train of the Nord Express family, which I planned to take soon, though rather on an entomological than mineralogical trip, but the revolution interfered with that project. My mother, Elena Ivanovna, August 29, 1876 to May 2, 1939, was the daughter of Ivan Vasilievich Rukavishnikov, 1841-1901, landowner, justice of the peace, and philanthropist, son of a millionaire industrialist, and Olga Nikolaevna, 1845-1901, daughter of Dr. Kozlov. My mother's parents both died of cancer within the same year, he in March, she in June. Of her seven siblings, five died in infancy, and of her two older brothers, Vladimir died at 16 at Davos in the 1880s, and Vasily in Paris in 1916. Ivan Rukavishnikov had a terrible temper, and my mother feared him. In my childhood, all I knew about him were his portraits, his beard, the magisterial chain around his neck, and such attributes of his main hobby as decoy ducks and elk heads. A pair of especially large bears he had shot stood upright with redoubtably raised front paws in the iron-barred vestibule of our country house. Every summer, I gauged my height by the ability to reach their fascinating claws, first those of the lower forelimbs, then those of the upper. Their bellies proved disappointingly hard, once your fingers, accustomed to palpate live dogs or toy animals, had sunk in through their rough brown fur. Now and then they used to be taken out into a corner of the garden to be thoroughly whacked and aired, and poor Mademoiselle, approaching from the direction of the park, would utter a cry of alarm as she caught sight of two savage beasts waiting for her in the mobile shade of the trees. My father cared nothing for the shooting of game, greatly differing in this respect from his brother Sergei, a passionate sportsman who since 1908 was master of the hounds to His Majesty the Tsar. One of my mother's happier girlhood recollections was having traveled one summer with her aunt Praskovia to the Crimea, where her paternal grandfather had an estate near Feodosia. Her aunt and she went for a walk with him and another old gentleman, the well-known seascape painter, Ivazovsky. She remembered the painter saying, as he had said no doubt many times, that in 1836, at an exhibition of pictures in St. Petersburg, he had seen Pushkin, an ugly little fellow with a tall, handsome wife. That was more than half a century before, when Ivazovsky was an art student, and less than a year before Pushkin's death. She also remembered the touch nature added from its own palette, the white mark a bird left on the painter's gray top hat. The aunt, Praskovia, walking beside her, was her mother's sister, who had married the celebrated syphilologist V. M. Tarnowski, 1839-1906, and who herself was a doctor, the author of works on psychiatry, anthropology, and social welfare. One evening at Ivazovsky's villa near Feodosia, Aunt Praskovia met at dinner the 28-year-old Dr. Anton Chekhov, whom she somehow offended in the course of a medical conversation. She was a very learned, very kind, very elegant lady, and it is hard to imagine how exactly she could have provoked the incredibly coarse outburst Chekhov permits himself in a published letter of August 3, 1888, to his sister. Aunt Praskovia, or Aunt Pasha, as we called her, often visited us at Vera. She had an enchanting way of greeting us as she swept into the nursery with a sonorous, "Bonjour, les enfants!" She died in 1910. My mother was at her bedside, and Aunt Pasha's last words were, "That's interesting. Now I understand. Everything is water. Usyo voda." My mother's brother, Vasily, was in the diplomatic service, which he treated, however, far more lightly than my uncle Konstantin did. For Vasily Ivanovich it was not a career, but a more or less plausible setting. French and Italian friends, being unable to pronounce his long Russian surname, had boiled it down to Ruka, with the accent on the last syllable, and this suited him far better than did his Christian name. Uncle Ruka appeared to me in my childhood to belong to a world of toys, gay picture books, and cherry trees laden with glossy black fruit. He had glass-housed a whole orchard in a corner of his country estate, which was separated from ours by the winding river. During the summer, almost every day at lunchtime his carriage might be seen crossing the bridge and then speeding toward our house along a hedge of young firs. When I was 8 or 9, he would invariably take me upon his knee after lunch, and while two young footmen were clearing the table in the empty dining room, fondle me with crooning sounds and fancy endearments, and I felt embarrassed for my uncle by the presence of the servants, and relieved when my father called him from the veranda. "Basile, on vous attend." Once, when I went to meet him at the station, I must have been 11 or 12 then, and watched him descend from the long international sleeping car, he gave me one look and said, "How sallow and plain, Jean et Lay, you have become, my poor boy." On my 15th name day, he took me aside, and in his brusque, precise, and somewhat old-fashioned French, informed me that he was making me his heir. "And now you may go," he added. "L'audience est finie. Je n'ai plus rien à vous dire." I remember him as a slender, neat little man with a dusky complexion, gray-green eyes flecked with rust, a dark, bushy mustache, and a mobile Adam's apple bobbing conspicuously above the opal and gold snake ring that held the knot of his tie. He also wore opals on his fingers and in his cufflinks. A gold chainlet encircled his frail, hairy wrist, and there was usually a carnation in the buttonhole of his dove-gray, mouse-gray, or silver-gray summer suit. It was only in summer that I used to see him. After a brief stay in Rojestvieno, he would go back to France or Italy, to his chateau called Perpigna, near Pau, to his villa called Tamarindo, near Rome, or to his beloved Egypt, from which he would send me picture postcards, palm trees and their reflections, sunsets, pharaohs with their hands on their knees, crossed by his thick scrawl. Then in June again, when the fragrant Cheriomuha, Racemos old-world bird cherry, or simply Racemosa, as I have baptized it in my work on Onyegin, was in foamy bloom, his private flag would be hoisted on his beautiful Rojestvieno house. He traveled with half a dozen enormous trunks, bribed the Nord Express to make a special stop at our little country station, and with the promise of a marvelous present, on small, mincing feet in high-heeled white shoes, would lead me mysteriously to the nearest tree, and delicately pluck and proffer a leaf, saying, "Pour mon neveu, la chose la plus belle au monde, une feuille verte." Or he would solemnly bring me from America the Foxy Grandpa series, and Buster Brown, a forgotten boy in a reddish suit. If one looked closely, one could see that the color was really a mass of dense red dots. Every episode ended in a tremendous spanking for Buster, which was administered by his wasp-waisted but powerful ma, who used a slipper, a hairbrush, a brittle umbrella, anything, even the bludgeon of a helpful policeman, and drew puffs of dust from the seat of Buster's pants. Since I had never been spanked, those pictures conveyed to me the impression of strange, exotic torture, not different from, say, the burying of a pop-eyed wretch up to his chin in the torrid sand of a desert, as represented in the frontispiece of a Mayne Reid book. 4. Uncle Ruka seems to have led an idle and oddly chaotic life. His diplomatic career was of the vaguest kind. He prided himself, however, on being an expert in decoding ciphered messages in any of the 5 languages he knew. We subjected him to a test one day, and in a twinkle he turned the sequence 5.13, 24.11, 13.16, 9.13.5, 5.13, 24.11 into the opening words of a famous monologue in Shakespeare. Pink-coated, he rode to hounds in England or Italy. Fur-coated, he attempted to motor from St. Petersburg to Pau. Wearing an opera cloak, he almost lost his life in an airplane crash on a beach near Bayonne. When I asked him how did the pilot of the smashed Voisin take it, Uncle Ruka thought for a moment and then replied with complete assurance, "Il sanglotait assis sur un rocher." He sang barcaroles and modish lyrics, "Ils se regardant tous deux en se mangeant des yeux. Elle est morte en février, pauvre Colinette. Le soleil rayonnait encore, j'ai voulu revoir les grands bois," and dozens of others. He wrote music himself, of the sweet, rippling sort, and French verse, curiously scannable as English or Russian iambics, and marked by a princely disregard for the comforts of the mute ease. He was extremely good at poker. Because he stammered and had difficulty in pronouncing labials, he changed his coachman's name from Piotr to Lev, and my father, who was always a little sharp with him, accused him of a slave owner's mentality. Apart from this, his speech was a fastidious combination of French, English, and Italian, all of which he spoke with vastly more ease than he did his native tongue. When he resorted to Russian, it was invariably to misuse or garble some extremely idiomatic or even folksy expression, as when he would say at table with a sudden sigh, for there was always something amiss, a spell of hay fever, the death of a peacock, a lost borzoi, "Je suis triste et seul comme une bilinka vepole," as lonesome as a grass blade in the field. He insisted that he had an incurable heart ailment, and that when the seizures came, he could obtain relief only by lying supine on the floor. No one took him seriously, and after he did die of angina pectoris, all alone in Paris, at the end of 1916, aged 45, it was with quite a special pang that one recalled those after-dinner incidents in the drawing-room. The unprepared footman entering with a Turkish coffee, my father glancing, with quizzical resignation, at my mother, then with disapproval at his brother-in-law spread-eagled in the footman's path, then with curiosity at the funny vibration going on among the coffee things on the tray in the seemingly composed servant's cotton-gloved hands. From other, stranger torments that beset him in the course of his short life, he sought relief, if I understand these matters rightly, in religion, first in certain Russian sectarian outlets, and eventually in the Roman Catholic Church. His was the kind of colorful neurosis that should have been accompanied by genius, but in his case was not, hence the search for a traveling shadow. In his youth he had been intensely disliked by his father, a country gentleman of the old school, bear hunting, a private theater, a few fine old masters among a good deal of trash, whose uncontrollable temper was rumored to have been a threat to the boy's very life. My mother told me later of the tension in the Vera household of her girlhood, of the atrocious scenes that took place in Ivan Vasilievich's study, a gloomy corner room giving on an old well with a rusty pumping wheel under 5 Lombardy poplars. Nobody used that room except me. I kept my books and spreading boards on its black shelves, and subsequently induced my mother to have some of its furniture transferred into my own sunny little study on the garden side, and therein staggered one morning its tremendous desk with nothing upon its waist of dark leather but a huge carved paper knife, a veritable scimitar of yellow ivory carved from a mammoth's tusk. When Uncle Rukad died at the end of 1916, he left me what would amount nowadays to a couple of $1,000,000 and his country estate, with its white-pillared mansion on a green, escarped hill, and its 2,000 acres of wildwood and peat bog. The house, I am told, still stood there in 1940, nationalized but aloof, a museum piece for any sightseeing traveler who might follow the St. Petersburg-Luga highway running below, through the village Rozhestvenno and across the branching river. Because of its floating islands of water lilies and algal brocade, the fair Oradesh had a festive air at that spot. Farther down its sinuous course, where the sand martens shot out of their holes in the steep red bank, it was deeply suffused with the reflections of great romantic firs, the fringe of our Vera, and still farther downstream, the endless tumultuous flow of a watermill gave the spectator, his elbows on the handrail, the sensation of receding endlessly, as if this were the stern of time itself. 5. The following passage is not for the general reader, but for the particular idiot who, because he has lost a fortune in some crash, thinks he understands me. My old, since 1917, quarrel with the Soviet dictatorship is wholly unrelated to any question of property. My contempt for the émigré who hates the Reds because they stole his money and land is complete. The nostalgia I have been cherishing all these years is a hypertrophied sense of lost childhood, not sorrow for lost banknotes. And finally, I reserve for myself the right to yearn after an ecological niche, beneath the sky of my America to sigh for one locality in Russia. The general reader may now resume. 6. I was nearing 18, then was over 18. Love affairs and verse writing occupied most of my leisure. Material questions left me indifferent, and anyway, against the background of our prosperity, no inheritance could seem very conspicuous. Yet, upon looking back across the transparent abyss, I find queer and somewhat unpleasant to reflect that during that brief year that I was in the possession of that private wealth, I was too much absorbed by the usual delights of youth, youth that was rapidly losing its initial non-usual fervor, either to derive any special pleasure from the legacy or to experience any annoyance when the Bolshevik Revolution abolished it overnight. This recollection gives me the sense of having been ungrateful to Uncle Ruka, of having joined in the general attitude of smiling condescension that even those who liked him usually took toward him. It is with the utmost repulsion that I force myself to recall the sarcastic comments that Monsieur Noyer, my Swiss tutor, otherwise a most kindly soul, used to make on my uncle's best composition, A Romance, both the music and words of which he had written. One day, on the terrace of his Pau castle, with the amber vineyards below and the empurpled mountains in the distance, at a time when he was harassed by asthma, palpitations, shiverings, a Proustian excoriation of the senses, se battant, as it were, under the impact of the autumn colors, described in his own words as the chapelle ardente de feuilles au temps violent, of the distant voices from the valley, of a flight of doves striating the tender sky, he had composed that one-winged romance. And the only person who memorized the music and all the words was my brother Sergei, whom he hardly ever noticed, who also stammered, and who is also now dead. L'air transparent fait monter de la plaine, he would sing in his high tenor voice, seated at the white piano in our country house. And if I were at that moment hurrying through the adjacent groves on my way home for lunch, soon after seeing his jaunty straw hat and the black velvet-clad bust of his handsome coachman in a Syrian profile, with scarlet-sleeved, outstretched arms, skim rapidly along the rim of the hedge separating the park from the drive, the plaintive sounds, "Un vol de tourterelles strie le ciel tendre, les chrysanthèmes se parent pour la Toussaint," reached me and my green butterfly net on the shady, tremulous trail, at the end of which was a vista of reddish sand and the corner of our freshly repainted house, the color of young fir cones, with the open drawing-room window whence the wounded music came. 7. The act of vividly recalling a patch of the past is something that I seem to have been performing with the utmost zest all my life, and I have reason to believe that this almost pathological keenness of the retrospective faculty is a hereditary trait. There was a certain spot in the forest, a footbridge across a brown brook, where my father would piously pause to recall the rare butterfly that on the 17th of August, 1883, his German tutor had netted for him. The 30-year-old scene would be gone through again. He and his brothers had stopped short in helpless excitement at the sight of the coveted insect poised on the log and moving up and down as though in alert respiration, its four cherry-red wings with a Pavonian eye spot on each. In tense silence, not daring to strike himself, he had handed his net to Herr Rogge, who was groping for it, his eyes fixed on the splendid fly. My cabinet inherited that specimen a quarter of a century later. One touching detail. Its wings had sprung because it had been removed from the setting board too early, too eagerly. In a villa, which in the summer of 1904 we rented with my uncle Ivan de Petersen's family on the Adriatic, the name was either Neptune or Apollo. I can still identify its crenellated, cream-colored tower in old pictures of Abbasia. Aged 5, mooning in my cot after lunch, I used to turn over on my stomach, and carefully, lovingly, hopelessly, in an artistically detailed fashion difficult to reconcile with the ridiculously small number of seasons that had gone to form the inexplicably nostalgic image of home that I had not seen since September 1903, I would draw with my forefinger on my pillow the carriage road sweeping up to our Vera house, the stone steps on the right, the carved back of a bench on the left, the alley of oaklings beginning beyond the bushes of honeysuckle, and a newly shed horseshoe, a collector's item, much bigger and brighter than the rusty ones I used to find on the seashore, shining in the reddish dust of the drive. The recollection of that recollection is 60 years older than the latter, but far less unusual. Once, in 1908 or 1909, Uncle Rukah became engrossed in some French children's books that he had come upon in our house. With an ecstatic moan, he found a passage he had loved in his childhood, beginning, "Sophie n'était pas jolie," and many years later, my moan echoed his, when I discovered in a chance nursery those same Bibliothèque Rose volumes, with their stories about boys and girls who led in France an idealized version of the vie de château which my family led in Russia. The stories themselves, all those Les Malheurs de Sophie, Les Petites Filles Modèles, Les Vacances, are, as I see them now, an awful combination of preciosity and vulgarity, but in writing them, the sentimental and smug Madame de Ségur, née Rostopchine, was Frenchifying the authentic surroundings of her Russian childhood, which preceded mine by exactly one century. In my own case, when I come over Sophie's troubles again, her lack of eyebrows and love of thick cream, I not only go through the same agony and delight that my uncle did, but have to cope with an additional burden, the recollection I have of him, reliving his childhood with the help of those very books. I see again my schoolroom in Vera, the blue roses of the wallpaper, the open window. Its reflection fills the oval mirror above the leathern couch where my uncle sits, gloating over a tattered book. A sense of security, of well-being, of summer warmth pervades my memory. That robust reality makes a ghost of the present. The mirror brims with brightness. A bumblebee has entered the room and bumps against the ceiling. Everything is as it should be. Nothing will ever change. Nobody will ever die. Chapter 4 1 The kind of Russian family to which I belonged, a kind now extinct, had, among other virtues, a traditional leaning toward the comfortable products of Anglo-Saxon civilization. Pears soap, tar black when dry, topaz-like when held to the light between wet fingers, took care of one's morning bath. Pleasant was the decreasing weight of the English collapsible tub when it was made to protrude a rubber underlip and disgorge its frothy contents into the slop pail. We could not improve the cream, so we improved the tube, said the English toothpaste. At breakfast, golden syrup imported from London would entwist with its glowing coils the revolving spoon from which enough of it had slithered onto a piece of Russian bread and butter. All sorts of snug, mellow things came in a steady procession from the English shop on Nevsky Avenue. Fruitcakes, smelling salts, playing cards, picture puzzles, striped blazers, talcum white tennis balls. I learned to read English before I could read Russian. My first English friends were four simple souls in my grammar, Ben, Dan, Sam, and Ned. There used to be a great deal of fuss about their identities and whereabouts. Who is Ben? He is Dan. Sam is in bed, and so on. Although it all remained rather stiff and patchy, the compiler was handicapped by having to employ, for the initial lessons at least, words of not more than three letters. My imagination somehow managed to obtain the necessary data. Wan-faced, big-limbed, silent nitwits, proud in the possession of certain tools, Ben has an axe, they now drift with a slow-motion slouch across the remotest backdrop of memory. And akin to the mad alphabet of an optician's chart, the grammar book lettering looms again before me. The schoolroom was drenched with sunlight. In a sweating glass jar, several spiny caterpillars were feeding on nettle leaves and ejecting interesting barrel-shaped pellets of olive-green frass. The oilcloth that covered the round table smelled of glue. Miss Clayton smelled of Miss Clayton. Fantastically, gloriously, the blood-colored alcohol of the outside thermometer had risen to 24 degrees Réaumur, 86 degrees Fahrenheit, in the shade.